Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And we have a report.
We do. And we were just in Seattle, and so much was going on, we were certainly not sleepless.
The only thing that wasn't going on was it didn't rain. The sun was shone every day.
It was
beautiful. And we spent a little bit of time outdoors, thank goodness, because otherwise we would have been missing the opportunity to see what Seattle can really be like. But we did meet some absolutely fascinating people associated with the Sustainability Summit of a group called the Chefs Collaborative, which has been in existence now for about 20 years and is a very dedicated group and some very interesting people within the ranks of the membership.
Well, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, so our audience should be prepared for that.
Assuming they did their homework, which they probably didn't.
Well, but here we are now with a program pretty much all related, or pretty much absolutely related, to the summit and to sustainability. And it's a good thing to start with two people who contributed enormously to the success of the program.
They were selected because of their interest, and also in part, I'm sure, because of their notoriety.
And that's not a good word in English, Robert.
It's not? Well, when I use it, it's meant as a compliment.
It's not.
Well, what's the American
contingent
version of it?
I don't know, but it's not notoriety. Notoriety has a scandal about it.
They're famous, whatever. Who doesn't know the name Ruth Reichel?
Right, and Kim Severson.
Of the New York Times Atlanta Bureau, but who's a foodie at heart, you can tell. And we had the opportunity to catch them both together for a fascinating exchange of opinions and thoughts about.
And Ruth, of course, did the keynote.
Yeah, well, I think Kim was considered a keynoter as well.
Yeah.
And we got him to keynote together, which was a whole lot of fun. And it was a great conversation to follow, which, of course, you're now going to hear.
This is really going to be a key interview for the Chefs Collaborative Sustainability Summit in Seattle, because we're going to address with Ruth Reichel and also with Kim Severson, what exactly does sustainability mean? You go first, Ruth.
Well, it can mean many things.
Right.
It has a very wide range, from being essentially walking lightly on the land, not destroying when you... In terms of food, when you're eating, making sure that you're using renewable resources, that you're not pumping fertilizers into the earth that are going to ruin the water table, cause huge dead zones in the ocean, and so forth, that you don't fish any fish into extinction, that you raise animals in a way that you're proud of, that gives these animals a decent life and does not fill the environment with unnecessary antibiotics. It also means paying people well for their labor, so that when hiring farm workers, that they're working in decent conditions and being paid fairly for what they're doing, that your meat workers are the same. So it has a very broad meaning. And ultimately, what it's about is that the food choices that we make, they're very crucial choices, and that eating is an ethical act. And that so real sustainability is being conscious of what your food choices mean.
Yeah, I like I can't remember who said it now, that what we're aiming for is to reach a point in time and sensibility where it's an automatic response to be and work sustainably. Kim, do you want to add to that?
Well, that's all absolutely true, but I think at the end of the day, people eat to nourish themselves, and you want to eat something that's delicious, and you want to eat something that makes you feel good. And so I think it's easy to go, oh, that sustainability stuff and that politics, I just want to eat. But if you bring people around and you say, well, what makes you feel good when you eat? Why does this dish taste good to you? Why did you have this great experience with people who were happy at the table? The food was good. And underneath all that are these ethics of sustainability. It's because that food was coming from a place where nobody was harmed in the production of that food, that the people who are cooking it and who grew it are getting treated well, and the animals come from a place that aren't being tortured before they're killed. That's an oxymoron, but the vegans will get on us here for that. But it is. Am I making the earth a worse place for my kids by eating this food? And all of that, I don't think people want to necessarily have to think about when they sit down and eat. But when they eat food that has all those underpinnings, innings, and they feel better, and the table feels better, and they're happier, and that's kind of what you want from food. So I think difficult to, when you're just trying to eat dinner, think about all these things, sustainability, or cook, or shop, but really
affordable
it's,
too,
yeah, and affordable, and that's actually kind of a misnomer when we talk about sustainability in food, and certainly at the restaurant level, things are going to cost a little more. I always say to people, like, how much did you spend on your cell phone and your tennis shoes? And if you look at what people or pay $4 for a cup of warm milk with a little coffee in it, well, food is not, grew up with that coupon mentality, like, well, I'm not going to pay that. Those tomatoes are 20 cents more a pound. It's just crazy, our economics in our head around food. And I think it's actually not that much to think about going to the farmer's market and getting some good tomatoes and some beans, and then maybe you have a little good piece of bacon from somebody, and you can make a little, I mean, Alice says this all the time, you can make pretty good food for not much money. It's our expectation.
Well, Michonne has a good thing going with this wholesome wave.
I
think we have to do more programs like that where you give people who are economically disadvantaged not only food stamps or whatever they're now called, double them when they're spending
Yeah, and people who are economically disadvantaged, let me tell you, have had to learn how to do a lot with less and are some of the better cooks you're going to find because they've had to be creative and they know how to do it. It's the access to the food to cook. I think there's an assumption that people who are poor don't know how to cook very well, and I find that to be specious because, boy, if you've ever not had much money and you want something good to eat, you really have to get creative. So it's the access to those vegetables, and the doubling of the SNAP benefits at farmers markets is a great thing.
Well, it's also, though, part of it is that food has become a status symbol, and so you have poor people who are wonderful cooks, but who their idea of how they do something wonderful for their family is buy a six-pack of Coke. And part of it is we have to really rethink food as you don't need to have meat three times a day. You don't need to have meat even once a day. And it's not a status thing. I mean, I think we have to teach people to cook again. And we also have to, like, recalibrate people's ideas of what food is. And for me, one of the problems about thinking too much about flavor is that the flavor is now being so manipulated. So it has to go beyond deliciousness, because if all we're talking about is really delicious food, the industrial food people make a strawberry that is more strawberry than strawberry. And we've got kids who have never tasted a cherry but think that cherry is some flavor that's been made chemically and that texturized to be the most pleasurable and so forth. So part of it is I think we really do have to get back to real food.
Now, Ruth, you just gave a clarion call to this Chefs Collaborative group, which is all about the responsibility of chefs in this particular group, at least, to be sustainable and all that kind of stuff. Summarize quickly the message that you gave to the assembled throng this morning.
Well, I basically said I have been writing about food for more than 40 years, and there has been a huge change. And I believe that the change has been largely chef-driven, and it's been a great change, and farmers markets come straight out of restaurateurs like Alice Waters serving people food that they didn't know existed anymore, and then people wanted to go out and be able to get it for themselves. But that chefs have now become famous, they're cultural icons, and with that comes, I think, a real responsibility. And if you want, you know, chefs are now becoming rich and famous, and if they want that side of the new chefdom, they also have to pick up the mantle and accept the responsibility of, we are national leaders now, so go out and do that. Introduce sustainability. I do believe it's real responsibility.
Well, there's a fine line here. I'm getting a little bit exasperated with the idea of chefs as saviors. I don't know if you've been picking up on that. Was it the G9, the letter from Brazil last year that everybody had to sign? And now, where are they? They're in Tokyo this year. And it's become a very exclusive club of who gets invited and so on. And they assume the savior role. What do you think about that, Kim?
Well, it was very interesting today at our session, the notion that so many things in our lives are becoming digitized. You don't have to go to a store to buy a book. You don't necessarily have to go to a movie theater to buy a movie. That tribal fire that we use as a culture is sort of dissipated in the digital age. But you can't replicate eating and restaurants. And that just was fascinating to me. So if you think about it, and more broadly, that eating and serving and cooking food is really the last place where we have that cultural tribal fire anymore, then chefs become incredibly important to keeping culture going. And so I think it's great that they're being asked to be at political table, if you will, that they are being invited into that. Now, I don't think that chefs are always the best political strategist or can articulate political positions very well. So sort of an interesting thing. But I think more than ever, chefs need to be part of that political discussion.
Well, and it's fascinating that Hillary Clinton just set up a whole, the State Department has now invited chefs to be an important part of diplomacy. And I think it was a brilliant move on her part.
I was really impressed.
Yeah, I was too. And I think it's really recognizing the new role that chefs have in our culture.
It's much harder to want to kill somebody that you've had dinner with, you know?
Now, I want to change direction for just a second here. Having said that the clarion call to chefs is very important and chefs have a tremendous role to play, we had a guest on the program within the last few weeks who said one of the problems in the United States is our food is too cheap. We are satisfied with cheap food, but we certainly get it for a price which is much less than the rest of the world pays. We just got back from Berlin, where we experienced sticker shock at the cost of meals in restaurants there, and part of it is because their food is so much more expensive.
Our food isn't really cheap. It's artificially cheap. We pay for it in other ways. Our food is cheap because of government policies that subsidize all of the wrong things. And that is the real problem, is that we don't understand that there are real costs to food and that we are paying a huge price for the cheap food that we have in health costs. The obesity crisis cost this country, the last figure I read was $155 billion a year. And factor that in to the supposedly cheap food we have, it suddenly doesn't look so cheap.
I'm going to say it's certainly the case that food is artificially cheap here, but you also have an economics situation. I do a lot of reporting in the South now. I'm the bureau chief in Atlanta. And so I see a whole lot of people who are relying on that dollar value menu in Walmart for their food. And it really is, it just seems to be like sort of no way out of it. Now, interestingly, Walmart is in the organic game. And so people know enough to want to reach for or the Walmart brand organic milk for their kids. There's something happening among people who don't have a lot of money to spend on food where they're willing to see an extra dollar and why that matters. And it's becoming accessible on this large level. And I think those
but
kinds
isn't
of...
isn't it actually that they're diluting the requirements for organic?
Well, it's true, but it's still a little bit better than what they were buying.
Yeah.
And I guess my point is that people who don't have a whole lot of money are starting to think
about it.
You know, that better food costs a little bit more money, and that's a mass change, and it's I think that hopefully USDA policies will start to respond to that in a way. I mean, there's a whole bunch of greenwashing and a whole bunch of watering down of requirements, and it's a long way to go before that Walmart house brand organic milk is perfect. But the fact that they've decided to do it and that a consumer without much money wants to reach for it, I think is a real sign of hope, as far away as it is from what we might think of as a perfect closed herd bottle of milk in a glass jar.
No, but it's a sign of hope, because at that point, when it becomes a mass movement and everybody starts saying, wait a minute, support family farms, stop supporting the CAFOs, stop making the price of sugar and corn artificially cheap so that meat is cheap. Start supporting family farms in the same way that you're supporting industrial agriculture, and then you've got a real change.
Right, and it's happening because consumers are pushing for it a little bit more, and then you have and I can't believe I'm going to use this phrase, thought leaders who are sitting at the table with Hillary Clinton, and food. Food is just, it's getting vertically integrated as a really important measure for social change, and I think it's just remarkable from what you were talking about this morning, when it was just unheard of to think about eating trash fish or in fine products. So it's, I think we sometimes get frustrated at this level, and we're like, oh, things are so terrible. But they're changing rapidly.
Oh, they're changing so fast. It's 7 years ago, I gave a speech to the newspaper editorial writers, their convention, where I was begging them to consider food issues. And I mean, you couldn't give that speech today. It would be ridiculous, because there are people at every paper whose job on the editorial board is to talk about food issues. That's how rapidly things have changed.
Well, you too. I could talk to you for another hour, but I'm getting signals that you're about to move on to your next obligation at the conference. I just ask you to continue doing the great work you're doing so we can keep this going forward. Final thought, Ruth.
Well, my final thoughts, I really am grateful for people who listen to this show and people who care about food. And I would just encourage people to cook dinner for someone tonight.
Thank you.
My final thought is basically I believe that the next big changes in food are not going to come from government. They're going to come from the grassroots.
And that's encouraging.
I think people are really going to pick up this issue, start demanding changes, and it's how ultimately we got rid of smoking in the way.
Okay.
And I think that food is going to be the same kind of issue that smoking was. And I really do expect huge changes that will come from the public.
Thank you both.
You're welcome.
And we'll be back with some more sustainability right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, of course, there were a number of people there in various guises, a lot of sponsors that are supportive of the sustainability
movement.
People who are good examples of what to do to be sustainable, speakers and so forth. I guess it was all akin. Everybody seemed to be on the same page, which is a wonderful point of view for a conference, I think. A summit, I guess, is what
right.
makes it different.
So in the next segment, we have...
Our old friend Paul Willis, that we've interviewed years ago.
Well, the funny part about it is he didn't even know sustainability. He knew that he was raising what he called outdoor pigs. And you'll hear the rest of the story as to how that became quite a large business, but also an extraordinarily sustainable business. And he got a very special award for his years of dedication to the sustainability movement.
Yeah, and they'll be followed
right
after
by him.
That.
Yeah, something that certainly needs sustainability because the Atlantic version of the salmon has been fished out for many decades thanks to man's irresponsibility. But on the left coast, on the west coast, they're a little more sustainable. And Mark Tupper, who runs a...
Who we just met for the first time.
Yeah, runs an organization called Triad Fisheries, which is the very model of sustainability.
Yeah. It's a business. I mean,
and a very interesting guy to talk to, to boot.
Yes.
So here's Paul and Mark.
Well, we're revisiting an old friend, Paul Willis, who we interviewed, I don't know how many years ago, Paul, it was, but it was a long time ago. Uh-huh. But Paul is at the Sustainability Summit, and as well he should be, because he was one of the early pioneers in sustainability and animal husbandry, particularly the welfare of pigs, little piggly-wigs.
Mm-hmm.
And explain the concept that developed in cooperation as part of the fold of Nyman Ranch Meats, which is certainly a really recognizable name in meat products.
I was raising outdoor pigs. Outdoor pigs.
As opposed to indoor pigs.
I'll tell you what was happening. Confinement animal feeding operations were starting to take a foothold in Iowa. We were seeing more buildings being put up. And these buildings put animals inside. There's no bedding, and they're generally over liquid manure pits. And it's concentrated animal feeding operations is what they're called. And I saw
CAFOs.
These CAFOs. I saw these, and I never wanted to raise animals like that. And so I started looking for a market for my, if you will, free-range pigs. And free-range chicken was already something in the marketplace at that time, and why not free-range pigs? And so I looked around for a number of years, and eventually I met Bill Nyman, who was in San Francisco, and I was telling Bill what I was doing, and it resulted in me taking some pork out of the freezer, sending it out to San Francisco, and it was sent around to some restaurants to sample the eating quality. And I honestly didn't know that the pork that I was raising was different. I thought it was all like that, which in fact it wasn't. And it was dramatically different than what had come to be the known as the other white meat, industrially raised pork. And so then we had to figure it out. How does a live animal get from Thornton, Iowa to San Francisco? I did my homework, contacted a packing plant, and in 1995, in February, we shipped the first 30 pigs, and it actually worked. So that was the beginning.
Paul, bear with me just a second. I wanted to ask a clarifying question. So you shipped them from your farm to San Francisco, and they were alive?
No.
Oh,
they were shipped to Supreme Pack in Northwest Iowa, okay. And they were shipped as primal cuts on a refrigerated truck. And then they were further processed and broken down into pieces that would be acceptable to various restaurant customers. And so from the very start, people loved the eating quality of the pork, and we decided to kind of define who it is and what we were, and that's when I decided that I wanted some kind of stamp of approval as far as animal welfare was concerned. I worked with Diane Halverson, and we wrote the pig husbandry standards, which basically are what we have today. But the industry, they weren't interested in having they couldn't have animal welfare approval because it wasn't animal welfare friendly.
But that's for sure.
So that became part of who we were, and then eventually we became a no antibiotic program. We didn't have any particular protocol initially, and then these things evolved. And I started looking for other farmers and neighbors, and little by little we built up a number of farmers, and today there are around 500 farmers in the Midwest and even some in the East.
Part of this network.
Part of the network. The farmers themselves own the pigs themselves, take care of the pigs, and if they meet our protocol, we go to all the farms and make sure everybody's doing animal welfare protocol, and then we buy pigs from these farmers and we pay a premium price. Nyman Ranch is really what enables those small farmers to reach marketplaces like Seattle or New York City or San Francisco or Cincinnati or different parts of the country. We have a national distribution system. Some goes to restaurants, retail, some is processed. And
do you realize how far advanced you were? I mean, you have to now be rather surprised, because it was also a natural process with you. And now the rest of the world, the community, the consumers are catching up to you in these mm-hmm. issues of animal husbandry and sustainability.
Well, I feel proud of the fact that we did start this, and of course there are other people doing various things as well, but some of our customers, when they recognized, thought about where their meat was coming from, started asking questions about, well, what about our beans? What about our tomatoes? What about our dairy products? So, I mean, that's kind of the bottom line here, is customers being inquisitive about the sources of their food and what goes into it and if they would be proud to put these items on their table.
Well, it's certainly really wonderful to look and see how many people are participating in this conference that share these same mm-hmm. ideals.
Yes.
Can I ask you something not off the record, but I mean a little bit off the topic? You know pigs very well, and I'm just very curious. What is a happy pig like? Does it have personality?
I think if you're out on my pasture, pigs play, and they run around, and they're social animals, and they interact with each other, and they're not doing that. They're resting, or they generally, when they lay down to rest, they want to be with each other, kind of in a pile or not next to each other. And
they snuggle, huh?
They do snuggle, and they interact with each other. There's not a lot of sound or squealing or anything like that. I mean, you can definitely identify a situation where the pigs are not happy.
Yeah, I was warned, because I used to spend my summers in my uncle's mm-hmm. dairy farm, and they had pigs. And my grandmother used to warn me to stay away from the pigs, because they could get really nasty.
Well, if you're a child, even an adult, you have to be aware that a mother in our situation, they're free to come after you if they feel that you're a threat.
If they have piglets, you mean?
If they have baby pigs. No, I don't ever allow anybody to, strike an animal or give them any reason to fear you. And that makes a huge difference. If they trust you and are confident around you, they're going to fear you, and they're not going to attack you.
So they interact well with humans when they're happy.
They certainly, yeah, they do. We had our farmer appreciation dinner recently, and we had maybe 50 people walking around the field, and the pigs are walking right around right among them and trying to chew on their pant legs and so forth.
Oh, dear. And are they as smart as everyone says?
Pigs are smart. If you kind of look, what is a pig? Who is a pig? They've got powerful shoulders, back legs too, and they have a kind of a shovel on the front of their body,
yeah,
made for digging. And they do, if they're in the wild, there are many kind of things that they're omnivores. They eat plant, animal, you know, a lot of different things. A cow, on the other hand, is just big and they walk around eating grass. And it doesn't take a lot of intelligence just to do that basic thing.
Somebody put it this way to us once, Paul. They said, they're all right at arithmetic, but they have trouble with calculus.
Yeah. All right, I'll agree with that one.
Anyway, we're going to have to let you spread more of the gospel, according to St. Paul.
Okay.
To people here at the conference, thank you so much for joining. It's such a pleasure to see you again, Paul. Thank you so much.
Well, we meet so many interesting people at this sustainability conference, or I guess it's called a summit. And I think it's because sustainability ranges all over the board, from products to people to jobs, the whole thing. And here we have Mark Tupper, who's president of Triad Fisheries, and he has a unique story to tell. And his product, of course, is appropriate for a summit in Washington State because it's salmon. Right, Mark?
Right. We do Alaska troll cod salmon. Now, there's three different fisheries in Alaska. There's the gillnet fishery, which is a small webbed fishery, usually in the mouth of the river or up the river. Then there's a purseine fishery with a big net that goes around in a circle and scoops up kind of like a purse once
the
fish are caught.
Hate that.
And then there's ours. And we're 3 to 5 miles offshore, actually, in the Gulf of Alaska. And our boats fish from the Canadian border, right where Canada and Alaska are, which is Prince of Wales Island, and we go all the way up to a place called Yakutat at the far end of southeast Alaska. So our boats are all 3 to 5 miles offshore.
Okay, and you line catch?
These are single line caught salmon. So our boats...
That's extremely important.
Yes, extremely important, because we want to really take care of this perfect gift from nature. So each boat is set up, and if you imagine, each boat has these two big, long aluminum poles. And the poles, one pole goes out from each side of the boat, port and starboard, and on that pole, there's about 10 lines. And each line has a lure and a hook on it. And so it looks like a little school of fish swimming behind the boat. So we go out and we basically are troll fishing and trolling versus trawling. Trawling is a big net that scoops up fish, which is not a great thing. Trolling is a very, very unique fishery because we only get maybe 50 to 100 fish a day. A good day for us is 100 fish. We really average around 50 salmon a day. But each salmon is treated with great respect.
And they're beautiful because you had three of them frozen here, and they were just gorgeous.
Yeah.
People kept trying to buy them right off this.
People kept coming by and touching them and thinking they were plastic because this fish is not
perfect,
this salmon is just coming in from the Pacific Ocean to school up. So these salmon are just getting ready to go home. So this fish has not seen fresh water, whereas the other fisheries in Alaska, generally the fish is coming into fresh water. Ours is still on the open ocean, so that makes us unique also. We're allowed to troll catch king and coho salmon is what we get. It's an amazing sustainability story in that we go all the way between Oregon and Alaska as far as who participates and how many fish we're allowed to take each year. So we have biologists not only from the states of Washington, Oregon, Alaska, and the state of Canada, but we also have the Indian fisheries involved. So we have Indian biologists that come in and actually meet with these people and do the whole thing.
Now, the we you're referring to is more than just Triad.
The troll fishery in Alaska, yes.
So that's the name of the group, and your boats participate in that.
We're a part of the troll fishery in southeast Alaska, yes, set up by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Now, when we talked to you earlier, you said it's interesting that you can only catch salmon with this method for a relatively short amount of the year.
Right. We are set up to fish from July 1st to about September 20th. In the state of Alaska, what we do is during the high tides in early August, these are the highest tides, basically, of August, we shut down all fishing in southeast Alaska. And that allows any fish that is going to come up and go up the rivers to go up the rivers. And Alaska has been blessed that there's lots of biology students in the United States. and they're all looking for summer work. So most of them are interns on these rivers and actually count the fish. So as far as fisheries go in Alaska, being able to count the fish going up the river means you've got enough escapement. You know what's going to happen with that river. So it's very easy to tell and make sure you have sustainability. And then with the river systems in the other parts between Washington, Canada, and Oregon, we also work with those biologists to make sure they're getting their escapements up their rivers, that we are not interfering with that, because we do get some fish that might be headed that way. Because if fish just start to scoop in the Gulf of Alaska as they're coming back in to go into Alaska, Washington, Oregon. So there's lots of work that goes into it. But in my mind, if you think about sustainability and you think about people having to make a decision, our Congress can't make a decision, but somehow you have this large group of biologists are able to tell us how many fish we can take each year and keep our product really sustainable and really high quality.
Now here's perhaps a silly question to finish up with, but what do the people do who the rest of the year? Do they go out and catch something else?
It's amazing to me. Many of our fishing families, they're either, they just raise their kids during the winter, a lot of them homeschool, a lot of them live in Alaska. The older fishermen whose children have moved out, who actually probably have left the boat and then come back to the boat, they tried working 8 to 5, they didn't like it, now they're fishermen with their parents. They usually go to Mexico during the winter, and they have sports fishing in Mexico, and they challenge each other every day to see who can catch the most fish, which just really amazes me that these guys are that dedicated and that enthralled to go fishing basically 365 days a year if they can.
Now, you have also a very special, I didn't know that you had to bleed these fish before you froze them, but you use a medical technique and it's all very clean and tidy, so that they're just sparkling examples of fresh and wholesome, aren't they?
So we start out trolling at about 2 knots. And that way, when the fish gets caught on the line, it goes into stress, basically. If I came up to you, your adrenaline would go off if I tried to mug you. So when you try to catch a fish, they let go some lactic acid. So we bring the fish aboard the boat. We live bleed it. We let that lactic acid metabolize. We let it slow down and let the fish sit there. And then we actually take off the head and pipette bleed the fish. So we're removing all the blood, because blood is unstable and causes bacteria. So we want to make sure the fish is extremely clean. So all the blood is removed from the fish. And then the fish is basically cleaned and moved from the back of the boat to the freezer on the boat and brought down to minus 30 degrees within 15 minutes from coming from the water. So basically, from the back of the boat to the freezer in 15 minutes, we're bringing it down to minus 30 and absolutely stopping any cell action in that fish and freezing it completely, so that when the fish is thawed, it finishes going through rigor and you have this perfect gift from nature coming right to the chef.
Having witnessed it, it really is a beautiful product. Thanks for talking to us about it. And the name of the company again is Triad Fisheries. Is there a website for this?
Yeah, it's just www.triadfisheries.com.
Right. And there's lots of information on your website.
We have, there's a video of the fish being caught. There's a video of a ling cod being caught that we didn't talk about today, and our sustainability and all sorts of things on there. Yeah.
Well, listeners, go to the website. And thanks again.
And thank you very much.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back with more interesting sustainability guests.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Just even thinking about our next guest in the interview makes me smile, because we had such a delicious time with one of my favorite people, John Riley of Taylor Shellfish, and we did a delicious slurp and sip.
yes, we did.
Yes, talking about oysters and wine, which if anybody has a question about either one or the two together, should contact John, who is an expert on it. You can actually tweet him at @oysterwine.
Yeah.
Anyhow, yep, he's fun.
And he's been working on this field for a long time. And not only that, but he speaks of oysters as being one of the most sustainable foods there is, and goes on to explain why. So if you listen carefully, you'll know the answer to that too. Well, here we are in Seattle still at Taylor Shellfish Farms, but not the farm. We're at a new concept for them. John Rowley, who's their spokesperson today. John, we're in the Melrose Market. Why?
Taylor Shellfish Farm opened a retail store here, right in the middle of Seattle on Capitol Hill. And we have oysters and mussels and clams and, you know, all the gooey duck and all the bivalves. And as far as the oysters, people wanted they wanted to be able to sit down and order a platter of shucked oysters. So we kind of cobbled together an oyster bar set up here. So, and then if you're selling oysters and platters of oysters, then you need a beer and wine license. So we got a beer and wine license. So now it gets pretty busy in here as the oyster bar component of it. It's very popular.
And we're here today, of course, to sample magnificent Taylor Shellfish oysters, but more than anything, to celebrate the intersection of oysters and wine. And John was not quite single-handedly, I guess, but probably pretty close to developing a concept called the Oyster Wine Competition. Tell us a little bit about that, John.
Yeah, well, it was pretty much single-handedly. This was my project. It's in its 18th year now, so it's got a little history. So there aren't many wines that go with oysters. And I was consulting with restaurants a fair amount back in the 80s and recommending French wines for oysters. I mean, restaurants that were selling oysters. And so I figured this isn't white. There's all of this wine country on the West Coast, you know, there's got to be some wines that go with oysters. So anyway, that led to a competition to turn them up. We call it the Pacific Coast Oyster Wine Competition, and we send out a call to entry to all the wineries on the West Coast and ask them to submit their best oyster wine, which is a crisp, clean finishing wine. Basically, what we're looking for is a wine that doesn't get in the way of the next oyster.
And the interesting thing is, you have more than one winner. So essentially, you give a seal of approval. This is an excellent wine to drink with oysters to about how many wines each year?
Well, we have 10 winners every year. That's the way we do it, because what we learn in the judging is that the judges have different palates, as do the people that are out there, you know, buying the oysters in the oyster bar. So we have 10 winners, and they're different from each other, but they all have one characteristic in common. They're crisp, and they finish clean.
And there's another thing you mentioned just to me just a few minutes ago, which was a surprise and new information, because we were going to display these fine bottles of wine that are getting ready for us to sample with oysters, but you said, no, we can't do that. The wine has to stay in an ice bucket because it needs to be really crisp and cold.
Yes. Well, you know, I've always thought that they're better that way with the oyster. And the oyster is stored in ice, you know, before the shucker opens them up and puts them on a platter, and then they're on a platter of ice. So there's an iciness to the moment. So and then if you take the oyster wine right out of the ice bath and pour a glass, you know, you get the fog on the outside of the glass, and it's part of it.
I have a question, maybe a dumb question, but once you determine a wine that goes well with oysters, are those wines going to go well with other shellfish too, like with Dungeness crab and say mussels or clams?
Some of them. Some of them are Pinot Gris from Oregon, and Pinot Gris tend to be a nice, you know, all-around sort of shellfish wine. The Sauvignon Blancs I don't think would work so well with crab, but where they're really good is in the summer. They're a good summer wine. They're light and crisp and clean, and they're really nice wines out in the patio in the summertime.
I want to put this in the context of you were a sponsor for the Sustainability Summit of Chefs Collaborative, which is why we're here, and you did this opening reception. which was absolutely fabulous. Usually it's viewed as not sustainable to have any kind of farmed seafood, but you say oysters, farmed oysters, are the ultimately sustainable product.
Yeah, I think any of the mussels, clams, oysters, those things, the mollusks in that category are probably the most sustainable seafood, if not most sustainable food. They eat naturally out in the bay. We don't have to feed them. We do have to reproduce them in a hatchery because we just wouldn't have an industry if we had to depend on wild. There's too many variabilities in the vicissitudes in the climate and everything to depend on a crop if they had to reproduce naturally. So they are reproduced in a hatchery. But once we get them as big as a thumbnail, we can put them out, and then they just feed on microalgae that's natural in the bay, and then at a certain point when they get big enough, we harvest them.
And through your experience with the oyster wine competition, you discovered a whole new concept that you implemented on a large scale for the first time just two nights ago, which is eliminating mignonette sauce and cocktail sauce and horseradish and other things that you might call condiments that people have with oysters, and instead you substituted something else.
Well, I think most people that really love oysters don't really need it. If the oysters are really good, they prefer them straight up, at least among the people I know. So I was always influenced by this paragraph. In fact, I got interested in oysters from this paragraph I read in a Movable Feast years ago as a young man. And it was about eating oysters in a cafe there in Paris after he finished his story and drinking the wine that they served there. And I don't remember the whole paragraph, but the last line was, "And then I lost the empty feeling and begin to be happy and to make plans." And it was just he was eating the oyster and sipping this wine with the oyster, and that paragraph has influenced me in my work with oysters. And so this competition that we do was to find those wines that do go with oysters, and once we've got them, there aren't many wines that go with oysters, but when you find one that does, it's a beautiful thing.
And you're quoting somebody else there too. You didn't make that. Oh, did you make that one up?
That's
yours. That's yours. And we have another one right here from Sheila Lukens. "Oysters on the half shell are a celebration, romantic, sexy, luminous. The right wine makes them even more so. So we're going to prove that now here at Taylor Shellfish in Seattle, Washington. And we're going to come back to you after we've done that and tell you some more about what we thought." Okay, Anne says, "I have the power. Because six dozen oysters later, I still have the microphone." And listeners, yes, I did wash my hands before picking up the microphone again. John, before we go to finish up by talking about the wines, you taught us how to taste an oyster with your hands and how to go through the process of eating and then drinking the wine. Would you do that for us?
My pleasure. Yeah, what I was trying to do was have you develop a certain intimate relationship with the oyster. So when you got to the wine, you know that it all kind of worked in the right way. So I'd like to guide people through this process and ask them if they knew that your fingers have taste buds. And everybody raises their eyebrows and whatnot. So I say, pick up an oyster. Pick up one of these oysters. What do you feel? What do you feel?
I'm being interviewed here. I feel something raw, something abrasive, something rocky, something like a shell.
Yeah, and if you've been through many oyster seasons and you pick up an oyster, you know what it is. It's an oyster, and your salivary glands start to work, and in a sense you start tasting the oyster before you get to it. So if we open the oyster and you, so we got two senses involved now. We've got sight, we've got touch, and then if you lift the oyster up and smell it, if it's a really good oyster, you'll just smell the fresh smell of the sea. And then if you take and slurp the oyster, what Tom Robbins calls, he says that's like French kissing a mermaid. And then if you slurp in the oyster and then you chew it, this is important just to combine right with the wine. Chew it as well as you can and let it go to every part of your palate. There's sweetness, there's minerals, there's salt, there's a number of different things that go in your palate. And then take a sip of one of these oyster wines that you've got chilled in an ice bath, and take a sip, and a good oyster wine will just finish clean and fresh, and you'll be ready for the next oyster. It's a beautiful thing.
Now, we had three out of your 10 winners from the 2012 Oyster Wine Competition: the Cedar Green Sauvignon Blanc 2010, Grandview, Washington. And I will admit, I like that one the best. Then we had a Dry Creek 2011, Clarksburg Dry Chenin Blanc, which John admits he liked the best. Oh, you didn't like that one the best. She liked them all equally. And then we had a Sockeye Pinot Grigio 2010 from Walla Walla, Center of the Wine Universe. Do you have any comments before we wrap up about those three wines?
Well, we have 10 winners of this competition for a reason, because people have different palates, and as you've tasted, there was one wine that you liked better than the others, and I don't know, what was your feeling, Ann?
Yeah, man, I liked the one that was a little bit stranger than the other two, the one that had a little bit of the cedar attached to it. I don't remember which one it was.
The Cedar Green Sauvignon Blanc or the Chenin Blanc?
No, I guess it was the Cedar Green.
It was the Cedar Green? Okay. The Cedar Green Sauvignon Blanc. And I like them all equally in their own way. What I ask from an oyster wine is that it just finished clean. And, it's got a crisp, clean finish. And that it doesn't get in the way of the next wine. And it gets you ready for the next wine, and all of these wine, and you drink them cold, and all of these wines, I think, accomplish that task. And there are three of the 10 winners, and they're different from each other, but they all work, I think.
I want to say, John, that the thing that you actually changed, the game changer of my life, was when you had me actually chewing the oysters thoroughly. I don't think I ever chewed oysters that thoroughly, and the amount of flavor released was extraordinary.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. So, what I suggest that people do is think of the wine. When you have wines in this style and oysters of this quality, to think of the wine as the condiment. Have the don't serve any if you serve condiments, they just interfere with the synergy of what we're doing here. So no condiments, and just use the wine as a condiment. Chew the oyster well, sip the wine, and it's a beautiful thing.
It's a wonderful way to spend 3 hours of the lunch hour. John, we thank you We had such a wonderful time. We can't wait till we do it the next time here in Seattle, Washington. And Anne has a final thought.
We did not get yet to the Dungeness crab, but I don't have any room. But next trip, John, because you devised a new hammer kind of thing.
Yeah, I devised a new way to crack crab where you can get the segments out intact with no mess and quickly.
Next time, and I love it. Thank you.
As you can tell, we were having a fine old time, and the audio quality suffered just a little bit, but I'm sure you got the message. And we'll be back with more sustainability guests right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
When it comes to sustainability, there are people who just do it right, and then there are people who don't. And fortunately, all the people that we ran into were doing it right. And we interviewed Kathy Wims, who we had interviewed before with a slightly different angle, and hoping to introduce you to her new venture, her restaurant in Portland, Oregon, called Oven and Shaker.
Yeah, sounds like it's a bar with pizza. Sounds like heaven, huh?
Oh, it does sound great.
But she also talks a good deal about why sustainability is important, and why chefs should be a part of it, and why she's a part of it as a result.
Right.
Then an interesting fellow who grows mushrooms in a highly sustainable fashion.
That his company is a pioneer in exotic mushroom cultivation.
Well, they cultivated on some kind of oak tree. What do they call it? What's a ground up tree? I can't get the word out.
Sawdust.
Sawdust. There you go. I couldn't remember sawdust. So Bob Engel talks about what you can do with sawdust, and no bullshit. How about that? And you'll understand why when you listen to the interview. And then to finish off, someone who's sustainable in a different way, sustaining a grand old American business that's been making knives since the middle of the 19th century and was at risk of going out of business, and she and her husband rescued it, and they're delighted with the product that they found.
And very
involved in Chef's Collaborative. And we applaud them for that, too. So that's how we'll finish up today's program, with those three interviews back-to-back.
Kathy Wims, it's so good to see you again. Nostradamus, and one to come called?
Oven and Shaker.
Oven and Shaker.
It's so nice to see you, too, Anne. Thank you.
But it's pizza, right?
It's pizza. It's a pizzeria and a bar foremost, actually.
I see.
my business partner, Ryan McGarian, is quite famous. He developed the recipe for Aviation Gin, which is Portland local gin, but is now nationally known and distributed all over the country. So he's an amazing bartender, mixologist, whatever you want to call him. And this is his bar. And it's a great big bar with delicious, fruity, amazing cocktails.
Yeah, of course, you mentioned Oregon. We should mention that this is where you're based, and this is where your restaurants are.
In Portland, Oregon.
In Portland, Oregon. And, of course, we love going to Portland, Oregon. What a fun city that is.
It is such an amazing food city right now. We have the best of ingredients of anywhere in the country, on par with almost anywhere in the world, I think. And we just have burgeoning, amazing restaurant scene of young, independently owned restaurateurs.
And now, I guess the question, since we are at the Sustainability Summit, what brings you to these events, the Chefs Collaborative Summits?
Well, this is the biggest conference that Chefs Collaborative have ever heard. I think it's the very first I've ever held. I think it's the very first summit meeting, and there's such camaraderie among the chefs here. And
more so than other chefs' events?
I feel like it. I definitely feel like it. I feel like everyone that comes is a chef or related in the food business or important person in food policy. There's just this opportunity to meet all these people.
Yeah, you agree on so many issues. I think that's probably the biggest draw.
And that really makes for a true camaraderie, because you're all in it for, making food available to people. Great great food available to everyone and protecting the food sources that we have in the world today.
What have you been most surprised about in terms of the issues? I've loved everything that's come up. I was really impressed with the salmon presentation today.
The presentation on Bristol Bay and the pebble mines?
Pebble mines.
That was a really great presentation. That's something that I had been aware of, but it was Paul Greenberg is such an inspiring speaker and funny as well. And so he just keeps you really engaged and keeps you on point about understanding the topic and really being able to absorb the issues.
And now you're not a book signer. You don't have any book out, do you?
No, I don't have a book yet. That's something I'd like to work on in the future.
It's a lot of work, isn't it?
I'm sure that it is. I'm more of a restaurateur right now, but I really would like to work on a book.
Well, now you're going to have to run this restaurant bar. You haven't had any experience in a bar, have you?
No, I haven't. That's why I'm relying on my partner. He's actually consulted all over the world for different companies in developing their bars, most recently at the Bellagio in Las Vegas. So
really?
He's very talented. I leave that part to him.
Yeah, because there's somebody really important in the field of beverage, of alcohol or spirits in Las Vegas. I can't remember who that is.
I probably wouldn't know. I'm sure Ryan would know in a second.
I'm sure, because this person, I guess, consults for Morton's and so forth.
Oh, okay. Well, I think that bar part of Oven and Shaker is in, like, able hands.
And what's going to be unique about your pizzas?
Well, we actually steered a little away from the traditional Neapolitan pizza style that we have at my restaurant Nostrana, and we're a little more playful because Ryan's cocktails, I think, are very playful and innovative. So our pizzas are, we like to use whatever is in season at the farmer's market, and we, all the vegetables that are happening, and even fruit. We have some pizzas that have fruit on them, including peaches and blackberries. So it's a little untraditional. It's a little fun and a little goofy maybe, but that's still
goofy.
Delicious pizza.
Could you just describe one of them? Just to get people thinking.
Our best-selling pizza is a salami pizza, and it has a spicy calabrese-type salami on it. It has roasted Fresno chilies that are roasted in the wood oven, so spicy chilies.
Wow.
And provolone, a really piquant provolone. And then at the very end, as it comes to the oven, it also has a bed of tomato sauce. We drizzle honey over the pizza, so the spicy salami and the sweetness of the honey have a really nice combination that people can't seem to resist.
That's a flavor profile that I'm very familiar with at Italian Sacro Dolce.
It does have a basis back to medieval times.
Yes.
So it's not like we're just making things up. There is some basis in history for the flavors.
Well, I wish you, of course, so much success with these ventures. Could you give our listeners a website so they could follow up and get more information?
Yeah, it's Oven and Shaker. .com and Nostrana.com.
Can't wait to go there. When were we in Portland last? We're due.
I think it was 2 years ago, maybe.
So
we really, Portland welcomes you back. We would love to have you.
Oh, Kathy, thank you. And thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Anne.
Bye. Of course, regular listeners know that I have many, many favorite subjects, but today, right now, we're going to be talking about one of them that's really high on the list, which is called mushrooms. And we're talking to Bob Engel, who is the chef liaison, public relations director of a company called Gourmet Mushrooms, Inc. And where are you located, Bob?
We're in Sonoma County, so that's an hour north of San Francisco.
Is that really good mushroom country?
Well, it's okay mushroom country. We've got a few spots that are good, but we're not talking about wild mushrooms. We're talking about cultivated ones, organic specialty mushrooms that are grown in a fascinating farmed situation.
Is it in caves like we do in Pennsylvania?
No. So let's talk about
mushrooms
a little.
Old mines, I think, we do in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, old mines, because white button mushrooms, and that group includes portobello, cremini, Italian brown, all of those mushrooms need to grow in the dark, and all of those mushrooms need manure to grow on.
That's what they grow on.
I don't like the dark, and I don't like manure.
I had to stop eating them raw when I realized what they were grown in.
So you'll be very happy to know that our mushrooms grow in the light, and they grow on sawdust.
Really?
Yes. red oak sawdust. We used to get our oak from the wine barrel manufacturers in Napa and Sonoma, and they don't have enough for us anymore because the farm has been growing. So now we get sawdust from a mill in Wisconsin, and this is the natural food for the mushrooms. So these are the kinds of mushrooms that
grow
that would
on
grow
logs
on.
And forests. Yes,
exactly. Yeah.
Now, you deal mainly with the chef trade, don't you?
We have a big presence in retail at Whole Foods around the country.
Okay.
But most of what we grow still ends up in a restaurant somewhere. We work both directly with chefs and through distributors all across the country.
And they're organic.
Yes. Yep.
Totally organic.
We were always pretty organic, but when we got certified, we had to explain to the organic certifiers what we were doing because the system is very unlike anything. It's not like hydroponics. It's not like soil. We're growing on sterilized sawdust, and our system never involved any kind of pesticides or artificial fertilizers, so getting organic certification was relatively easy, other than explaining to them what exactly the heck we were doing.
Now, are these the types of seeing the pictures in this brochure? Are these the ones that you specialize in? There's clamshell, alba, clamshell brown, trumpet royale, which are wonderful.
That's like a king oyster, that trumpet royale.
Oh, it's fabulous,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Then we've got forest namico and velvet piapini. Hardly anybody grows those. Nebbiolo bianco, we're the only farm in America growing that one. And maitake, which is also known as hen of the woods.
Yeah, which is one of my favorites, the meaty.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody showed us one of those once, and we were just astounded.
How big was it?
Oh,
sometimes
fist size.
Yeah, because in the East Coast area, you can get wild hen of the woods that'll get to be a foot and a half in diameter.
Yeah, what we got was a wild one.
Yeah,
I can't remember where we got it from. We told a chef friend of ours about this. He had never heard of them before, so he put them on his menu right away.
Yeah. Chefs love mushrooms. I tell chefs, and I was a working chef before I started working at the farm.
Oh, that's interesting.
I bought mushrooms at the farm for 10 years, and I was never allowed to see inside. So I tell people that I got a job there just so I could see
inside.
See what's inside.
I wanted to ask you a question about something that really surprised us at the time. And I'm wondering whether you think it works, since I'm sure you're an expert on mushrooms cultivation generally. This was at the Fancy Food Show two years ago, I think. This particular company had invented a sort of a grow mushrooms at home.
They're still going
kind
great.
Of, kind of kit.
Kit. Was this BTTR?
Back to the roots. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. But we never could get any samples to test to see if it actually grew mushrooms.
Does it work?
I will get samples sent to you because I know those folks. They're in the Bay Area also.
Okay.
They're growing partially on coffee grounds
That's it. But I never knew whether the system worked, so we've never talked to them.
Because you just get a kit.
You get a kit, and I have to tell you that overall, the feedback that I get from people who grow kits, and not just the Back to the Roots people, but other kits as well, your success rate will be somewhere between 50 and 90%. I would say everybody has a few failures, but for the most part, the kits work pretty well.
Okay, so it's a valid thing to do.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I've had other kits, and they have not worked.
Uh-huh.
But it's a whole lot easier to deal
mushrooms
with.
Mushrooms aren't that easy to grow. I mean, it's a relatively simple system. When chefs come through the farm, they say, is this easy? I say, well, is making bechamel easy?
Yeah.
As long as you get everything right at every stage, it's easy. But if you burn the roux or if you lump the cream, then you got a mess. Same thing with mushrooms. It's relatively simple to wrap your mind around what needs to be done, but making sure that you do every stage correctly is the key that we've found. Because when I started with the farm 10 years ago, we were growing 2,000 pounds a week, and we now grow 20,000 pounds a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, there's the Manoir Quatre Saisons in England and the UK. They have an outdoor, it's sort of a damp, woodsy thing where they grow wild mushrooms.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
that does work. You can put them in logs outside.
Yeah, that's what they
But
do.
We grow indoors. We grow in actually a little plastic bottle that we fill with sawdust and hand harvest every single mushroom.
Wow. So this explains why you're involved with sustainable agriculture, huh?
Exactly. We're growing food out of sawdust. And when we're done growing that, we compost that sawdust and return it to the soil. So it's a nice, clean, sustainable system. The thing that I always tell chefs, and I wanted to mention before we end, is that mushrooms behave in the kitchen more like meats than they do like vegetables.
Yes.
They've got a very satisfying mouthfeel, especially the wood-grown varieties. They've got umami.
Yeah.
And they've got umami because they've got all of the amino acids, just like meats do. Yeah. And
how about a website?
Website? Mycopia.com. So MYCOPIA.com. Our brand name at retail is Mycopia because gourmet mushrooms wasn't something we could trademark.
Okay.
It was too generic a phrase.
Right.
But in the stores around the country, you'll see us as Mycopia, and Mycopia will also get you to our website.
Well, I look forward to looking out for them, Bob, because that's my favorite thing, as I told you.
Thanks, Ann.
Thanks for talking to us.
Great.
I really don't know what I was thinking when I ran into Mimi Yonkins.
Yes.
But she said, because we're at a culinary conference, she said that they made knives, so I assumed that they were kitchen knives. And then I found out it's a fraction of what all you do, a nice good portion of it. But still, you started out when? Give us a real short history of this company called R. Murphy Knives.
R. Murphy Knives was established in Boston in 1850 by Robert Murphy. And my husband and I bought it 3 years ago. We're only the fourth owners in 162 years. It went through the Murphy family down to the sons, then to another family in the 50s, and the family before us in the 60s, and then we just bought it from them.
What made you want to own a knife company?
Well, that's a good question. We were in the construction business. The economy was tanking, as you know, and through friends, we had heard about R. Murphy Knives, and the previous owner was getting ready to let it go, and so we talked to him and decided to buy it as an investment. Then once we started learning the knife business, we found out that we make fantastic knives, and we fell in love with our product.
Well, your product is so diverse. I mean, I'm looking at the first page of your brochure. It says shoe and leather knives.
Right, because it's so old, the knife manufacturing business in this country actually started in like New England, well, like Massachusetts, New York, Connecticut, Pennsylvania. So the old New England industries were shoemaking, leather products, fabric mills.
Yeah, there's mill and rubber knives.
Exactly. And so when these knife manufacturers were started, they were making, you know, tools for the trades. And
Flooring, roofing,
surgical knives, dental knives, all the steel. The country was only not even quite 75 years old yet, so we weren't even making steel. We had to import steel from Germany and England, and even the craftsmen had to be brought
really?
Over to teach here. And so Robert Murphy and his brother John were part of this beginning of this movement of making knives. And then, you know, there were military knives. And
The thing that got my attention immediately was when you said in the culinary sector that you made, was it 30 or 40 shellfish knives?
Yes, we make over 30 shellfish
and
knives.
And what oyster, crab, scallop, clam, but how do you get 30 or 40 of those?
Well, there are many kinds of oyster knives. There are several kinds of clam knives, and there are a few kinds of scallop knives. And one reason is because that now we pretty much farm our oysters, but oysters used to be native, and they used to be many different sizes.
So it's sizes,
shell type, hardness, and then also there's preference from the shucker. So there are many reasons there are different types of oyster knives, but the traditional ones are all named for their area, the New Haven, the Providence, the Boston, the Seattle, the Chesapeake, the Gulf oyster. And we still make all of those because when everyone was first making knives, that was a tool that everyone wanted, an oyster knife, like a corkscrew.
Now, do you make chef's knives as well, kitchen knives generally?
Yes, we've been making chef's knives and butcher knives since probably the early 1900s, and we still use carbon steel.
Which is my favorite knife. I still have one from the 60s.
And that's because it's such great steel, takes an edge much better, it holds the edge longer, it sharpens easily, and when you sharpen, it does not diminish the integrity of the blade.
See, I didn't know you could still buy them, or I'd have a whole slew of them. I only have one.
Yes, some companies still make them, but they don't promote them
But we are. We're, because of this, you know, movement of just everything we're here at the Chef's Collaborative, sustainability. You're going to buy this 10-inch or 8-inch chef knife, and you'll never need another one.
Yeah, see, this is it. I mean, mine's still going from the 60s.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, how do people access your knives?
On our website.
Which is?
rmurphyknives.com. You can see all the knives we make, which you will be astounded, not only yes. of the amount of oyster knives, but hunting knives, whittling knives.
And they're beautiful. You have a
Thank
display
you.
Here at the conference, and I mean, they're just beautifully made.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations. You know, something that happened almost accidentally to your lives has really become a delight and a joy.
Yes. Yes.
Well, Mimi, it was great running into you and seeing your product line.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
We'll be visiting with a couple of Seattle chefs that we met who were very instrumental in the conference. I think, you know, I came away with a really good feeling. It was a feel-good event and a feel-good program that's going on, that's doing something really important for America. And if you don't believe that, listen to Kim and Ruth all over again at the beginning of the program, and you'll realize just how important all of this is. And in the meantime, that's all we have for this week. We'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.